My name is Joe Ross. I'm the president of CSID. CSID is a leading provider of global enterprise-level fraud and identity theft protection services. And our topic today, we chose data breaches, taking the bull by the horns. The reason we chose data breaches was because in the recent year, I think a lot of people are more aware of what's happening in that space with the likes of Sony, Stratfor, Citi, and many of the other high-profile data breaches. It's becoming more and more prevalent in the marketplace, and we think that businesses need to take a more proactive approach to protecting consumers' information. But also, once something should happen, what do you do to respond to that accordingly? And that's what we're going to cover here today. We brought in a series of experts. Starting on our far end, we have Terry Heemeyer. He's a senior lecturer and advisory member for the University of Texas at Austin. He is an expert in crisis and issue management. The next one, if I get this right, I'm going to be doing well here. Monica Janjowska. So Monica works with Hunter and Williams, and she advises clients on a broad range of complex privacy and data security matters, including state, federal, and international privacy and data security requirements. Next to Monica, we have Joseph DeMarco with DeVore and DeMarco. Joe specializes in representing and counseling clients in complex issues involving information privacy and security. And finally, next to me, we have Michael Brimmer. Mike's the VP of Data Breach at Experian. Experian is the world's leading provider of consumer data breach solutions. And to get us started here, I guess I could have did that a little earlier. This is what I just covered for you guys. So to get us started, what I'm going to do is tell you a little bit about what the leading cause of a data breach is. Most folks think about anonymous and those type of events when they think about data breaches, but the majority of a data breach occurs internally with a company's own policies, procedures. And as you can see up here, the number one cause is a negligent insider, meaning one of your own employees doing something that they shouldn't be doing. Outsourcing data to a third party, it ranks second, and then a malicious insider, that's an employer who's actually a hacker. The rest of these, as you can see, the cyber attack is really only 7%, and those are the ones that tend to get the most publicity because those are where all the blogs happen with Anonymous and the others tweeting about various things. But the, most of these, as you can see, are just failure to shred, data lost in physical delivery. They're just internal processes and control mechanisms. Those are things that as a company you can actually take efforts to control and educate your employees on. Now the next slide I'm going to hand over to Terry, and Terry is going to kind of give you an overview of data breach and how to manage the actual impact of that on your company.
If you don't mind, I'll stand up. You can hear me, I guess. This subject, in an hour, it's unbelievable, and I go back to the BP disaster. The Admiral said handling this subject is like drinking from a fire hose. It's almost impossible. So we're going to try to get our 1,000 pounds in a one-pound bag during this session. Besides teaching, and I've had a long career in crisis, but I've spent 6 years as the manager and the head of information technology for a major energy company. And then through my teaching, I talked to numerous companies every year about their crisis management, and I especially cover data, digital, internet issues that they have. So I think I'm pretty good up to speed on what they are and, more important, what they're not doing. I'm going to cover maybe the magnitude, ramifications of the problem, companies that aren't giving this a priority and the reason why, warp speed, which is obvious that we have to work at when we have these things happen. Talk about leadership. Do we have the right leadership running our information technology operations? And then how to avoid it. If I could do that, I could make $1 zillion, but I'll give you my take on that. Okay, the magnitude of the problem, it's a huge problem, and most companies are not prepared. I interview a lot of, in the energy business alone, 40% of the executives I talk to expect a major attack within a year, meaning loss of services, 24 hours or more, loss of life, failure of a company in some cases. 70% have frequently found malware designed to sabotage systems. 60% of these energy companies have found the virus Stuxnet in their systems. This virus took down a nuclear centrifuge in the Middle East in the past. Only about 50% of the energy companies I talk to have increased their security budgets for this type of thing. So that's a problem. It's a matter of priorities with CEOs. In addition to all the breaches that go on with our personal information that happen. Anyways, these things attack multiple systems. They attack financial systems. They attack physical plants, control systems of chemical, nuclear, electricity plants. They attack mobile communications. They attack message routers. And I know of a software company, I talked to them about a month ago, that has over 1,000 breaches a month that they're trying to handle. They go after, when I was in the business, they would go after our customer information, our sales, our what people pay for it. They go after our product formulas and how we, and that's very super secret with most companies, no matter what company you are. And then they go after our priority projects that are confidential. Where are we going to drill next? Where do we think there's oil or natural gas or shale or whatever? So that's the kind of things they go after. And I really agree with this slide that most people think it all comes from outside sources. I would say 70%. This says 61% of security breaches are caused from internal sources. This is internal issues, bad management, no controls, bad decisions, non-reporting, which is a huge problem, criminal behavior, and pissed off employees. That's where this stuff comes from. I would say 70%. Okay, that's inside. Who's the bad guys on the outside? Now, last week, the FBI arrested numerous hackers. Some of them were part of this Anonymous group around the world. Anonymous shut down the Vatican website last week. They've shut down the CIA. They've shut down FBI. That's how they can do this kind of stuff. But they caught a guy. They caught a guy, and the guy turned into a snitch, and he told on everybody. His name was Sabu, S-A-B-U. He's helping them. This guy is self-taught, unemployed programmer, no college degree. He's on welfare. He's in public housing in New York, and he was considered the most wanted and feared computer vandal around. His mother was quoted in the paper, said, "My son has 168 IQ with no brain or wisdom." Among those caught that he fingered, they caught the guy that hacked into Stratfor here in Austin, 160,000 victims. So that's the magnitude. Let's talk about playing defense, and I see that as a huge problem. Most companies and organizations don't have a preventive strategy. They're on the defensive. They wait for something to happen, and then it gets out of control. Stratfor CEO was quoted in the paper, "As we grew or failed, we failed because our data protection didn't grow with us." Now you got WikiLeaks out there, and they're just releasing everything, and I'm sure those emails are really fun for these people to read. So I would maintain a lot of companies I talk to do not have an aggressive priority. They don't know their vulnerabilities. They don't have any intelligence. They don't assess what really and test warning signs. Monica here, thank God, is in the business of identifying risks, managing risk, evaluating, that type of thing. So we need more of that, and we need companies to do that. Typical, and it still happens when I was in charge of IT, it's still happening today. A data breach happens, some bad event happens. IT addresses it, they chase it, they don't alert anybody else, they handle it themselves, they try to isolate it, they restore it. Once it's out of control, it's too late. And they haven't alerted other functions like finance, accounting, HR, corporate security, the C-suite, contractors. They try to do it themselves, it's a huge mistake. It's sort of like kids in the backyard playing with matches. It's out of control, it's too late. Warp speed, I'm not going to say much about that because everybody knows everything's at warp speed today. Everything's got to be done quicker. When I was in the business, we had one data breach. Today they have 100 for every one we had there. So it just makes it imperative that we're working 24/7 to solve these problems. I think somebody might ask me some companies that have done pretty well on this, so I won't talk about the company now. Okay. Leadership, I see, is a big problem, and some people might disagree, but I think we have the wrong people running information technology. In most big companies, it's called the CIO, and that person is probably critical, mission critical, to the success of an organization if it's the right person running it. Who is the CIO? It's usually a computer-trained information technology IT person, very smart, very intelligent, but very specialized, and doesn't necessarily understand the business priorities of a company and what priorities are, like budgets, ROI, that type of thing. So he can't necessarily solve business problems. And I know of an example where a CIO went up to a chairman. He had about a $10 million problem with a data breach. Went to the CEO and says, sir, I have a really big problem. I got this thing happen, and I need another $10 million for my budget to solve this problem. And the CEO looks at him and says, you got to be kidding. Brenda, you got to be kidding. I'm paying you $400,000 a year. You have an $80 million budget, and you don't have the brains enough to move some stuff around, prioritize, and fix the problem. He said, I'm not going to give you the extra $10 million. That's a problem. If he had more credibility with the CEO, he might, and he knew how to manage his business, it could have worked out better. And I think budgeting is a key thing that they don't have a good handle on. And again, they say, well, you got to have an IT person to run IT. And that's the analogy that I make a lot of times. You don't need a race car driver to run a General Motors. You don't need someone that has sold lingerie to manage a Victoria's Secret store. So you need a well-rounded business person. There's no incentive for anybody to go into be CIO because they don't really get promoted that much. I would suggest that to be a CEO, the big wheel, the board of directors says, I want to see someone that has some IT experience, and then they can promote them. Okay, so what do you do? Well, I've had suggestions like hire Sabu, the guy that just, hire him. Hire criminals. They can help you solve these problems. Hire the teenagers that sit in dark rooms, never go outside, and they're expert at what they do. But more to the point, I think companies need to get objective outside experts to help and advise them. They need to create a cyber data breach team to uncover, prevent, and respond to these crises. Their most important job is to assess vulnerabilities. They don't do enough of that. And you need to include on this team people from other functions in the company like HR, accounting, finance, legal, operations, that type of thing. Create a risk, just like a crisis plan, create a risk management protocol, guidances, processes, procedures, and even though it might change the first day after the crisis, at least you've got a roadmap to start with and the key people involved in solving the problem. Okay, last but not least, I call it the hangover. After it's happened, what do you do about just happening? First of all, if you still have a job and if your company's still around, you need to pull the team together, analyze what happened, how did it happen, and how could it have been prevented. Thank you.
We're going to go through the questions here at the end, so if you guys will just hang on to those. But one thing Terry did mention that people need to consider that if you've ever gone through a breach, it is a disaster, and you need to have a disaster recovery plan just like the other aspects of your business. I've worked with Stratfor and with Sony, and the people that are scrambling on that side of the equation, they wish they would have had a plan in place. And so with that in mind, we're going to let Monica kind of run through a couple slides on what a data breach response timeline should look like.
Thanks, Joe. So there are generally 8 steps to a security breach response timeline. Please keep in mind, it doesn't matter if you're a startup or a well-established company, how small or big your breach is, these steps should always take place. You discover there has been a data security breach, and I'll come back in a moment to what is exactly a security breach. But let's say somebody notifies you in the company, we have a problem, we have a breach. What do you do next? You need to mobilize. You need your incident response team to be gathered and start acting. The first thing you need to do is stop the vulnerability. You need to preserve the data, safeguard what has been compromised. And you also have to start thinking right away about collecting evidence for the future investigation. How do you investigate? You may need to hire forensic experts. It's very possible that your IT department is very capable of doing the investigation and analyzing the data, but keep in mind that if there's a class litigation at the end, it's always better to have an outside company perform the forensic analysis. At the same time, you have to start preparing the documents you'll need to communicate. So what do you need? You need letters that you'll send to the affected individuals. You also may need letters to communicate with regulators, consumer reporting agencies. Depending on the data at issue, you also may have to issue a press release. You also may decide to post some materials on your website. Depending of how big and sensitive the breach is, you may decide to hire a PR firm to help you with the messaging, and of course always a law firm to make sure you're stating accurately what you should be stating. Next, you need to mitigate, depending of the population at issue, if this is a significant breach, you may need the help of an outside call center that will handle the calls of the individuals that have been notified. You also may need to hire a service provider that will offer credit monitoring services to the affected individuals. And then finally, the day comes when you're ready to notify. Again, keep in mind, if this is a large breach, you may not have the internal resources to be able to do the mailings. If you're talking about millions of people that need to be notified, you may have to hire a mail house. And you also have to be ready to answer media inquiries on the day you go public, because privacy breaches right now are very popular with the media and they get a lot of attention. Finally, you're out there, the event is public, it's a good time to review and improve the company's information security program so you can incorporate all the lessons learned. So back to what's a data security breach. Breach requirements are imposed primarily by state law. There are some requirements imposed by federal law in the financial services and healthcare sectors. That means that if you're dealing with financial data and healthcare data, you may be subject to federal law. In general, under the state laws, the duty to notify arises when unencrypted computerized personal information has been acquired or accessed by an unauthorized person. What's personal information? Typically, it's an individual's name combined with a social security number, a driver's license or a state ID number, and or a financial account, a credit or debit account number with the security code. But the laws are not uniform and breaches are all different. They range from a laptop being lost by somebody in your HR department to a very sophisticated cyber attack on your networks. And recent big breaches also have changed a little bit the notion of what is personal information. I think a great example is Epsilon. If you're familiar with the breach, the data at issue consisted of names and email addresses. A name and an email address is not personal information under the state breach laws, but the company decided to go ahead and notify regardless.
On to the next one, we're going to have Joe. As Monica mentioned, she kind of went through the timelines and what actually, how you need to respond to a breach. Joe's going to talk about the risk. And when we say risk, what is your exposure as a company if your organization should have a breach? So Joe, go ahead and take us to the next one.
Thanks very much. And I echo everything that that Monica and Terry said and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. Is this microphone on?
It is.
Okay, great. Can you guys hear me now? Okay, thanks very much. So I bring a somewhat unique perspective to the table. For 10 years, I was a federal prosecutor in New York, and my special area of expertise was cybercrime. I founded and ran the cybercrime unit at the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. And so I spent the better part of a decade from 1997 until 2007 when I started my own boutique law firm chasing data thieves, hackers, web page defacers, and you know malefactors of all kind in the cyber realm. And in 1997, if some of you recall back to then, probably many of you were in high school, there were no data breach laws and no reporting laws at all. And as a result of that, many data breaches simply never went reported. And because they never went reported, people never heard about that. All that changed in the early part of this century when a number of states started passing these data breach notification laws. And that's when, for the most part, you started to read about these massive data breaches. And today, you can't pick up a newspaper in any given week without hearing about the latest one. What has that meant? Well, it's meant a couple of things. First, it means that companies can no longer sweep a data breach under the table. It means they have to air their dirty laundry in public. Secondly, it means that they don't have control over how events unfold when they do air that dirty laundry in public. The third thing it means is that it gives regulators who see public outcry over these data breach a hook to pass legislation which requires those companies to then have good security. So many of you are aware of the fact that, you know, last year Massachusetts passed a data privacy and security law, which made companies who have personally identifiable information on even a single Massachusetts resident no matter where that company is located, to have a written information security plan. Those laws didn't exist before, in part because the breaches weren't reported, and in part because there wasn't the public outcry over these types of breaches. The third thing that's happened is the plaintiff's class action bar, which is the group of lawyers that specializes in suing companies, large and small, has discovered privacy as the new tort of the decade. And so what we see now, it kind of almost is like a play, it's kind of very formulaic, is you'll see that there's a major data breach. You'll then see the publicly reporting required by the company. You'll then see the plaintiff's class action lawsuits being filed by plaintiff's class action lawyers. And then you'll see a regulator, the FTC, the SEC, or a state AG, bringing an action against the company. And so it's really kind of like a parade of horribles, and it just kind of plays out this way every single time. Of course, there are variations. I mean, if you're Sony, you know, you're facing 88 class action lawsuits, and you're spending hundreds of millions of dollars responding to a breach. If you're a Stratfor, maybe you're only facing a couple of class action litigations and only 10 millions, you know, in the tens of millions of dollars of losses. But whoever you are, you can pretty well be sure that your pain is going to be consistent with your size and scale. You're also seeing regulators hop on the bandwagon as well, and the FTC and state AGs imposing fines and requirements that companies undergo very rigorous audits and inspection of their security procedures. And all of this has created a lot of big headaches for companies, large and small. Now, what happens in a typical data breach in addition to those costs that I mentioned? Well, you have a loss of goodwill. You know, companies who have these data breaches do face significant public backwash from their customers. And not every breach is the same. I mean, I'll give you an example. I teach a cybercrime seminar at Columbia Law School. And, you know, we cover data breaches. Pretty standard stuff, right? Most of the time, for most of the years that I've taught the seminar, most kids in this class were pretty tuned out to data breaches because it didn't affect them. Everything changed last year with the Sony PlayStation data breach. All of a sudden, my class really cared about data breaches. Why? Because they couldn't play on their Sony PlayStations because the system was shut down. Now, obviously, every kind of breach is going to affect a different consumer base in a different way, but you see the point. Whoever your consumer base is, if you lose their PII because of negligence or because of a data breach, they're going to care. It's also going to hurt you because it's going to provide a powerful disincentive for your consumers to provide information about themselves, accurate information that you can use and you want to use to monetize the data that you're collecting through your website. And then finally, of course, no one likes to be pilloried in the press. If you recall, the Sony PlayStation breach and the Epsilon data breach resulted in the two general counsels of those companies being called before a congressional committee and being grilled by Representative Bono and Representative Pence. And of course, you know, once you're there in front of the, you know, in front of the Congress with the bouquet of microphones and the Greenfelt tablecloth, you've already lost because there's nothing you can say that they're not going to hop on you to get all over you. Next slide, please. All right, so what do you do about this conundrum? Well, look, technical steps and technical security is a good first step. The biggest single mistake that I see as a legal practitioner in this field is that companies, again, big, small, medium sized, doesn't matter, they think that's the beginning and end of it. They care about what's inside the firewall, what's outside the firewall, and that's it. They think of that as an IT issue. This is not an IT issue. It's an issue that combines IT security best practices with policies, procedures, and legal best practices all in one unitary whole. And that's what I think the most important thing that I have to offer you today is. What are some of the things that every company should do in my mind? First, every company should conduct a comprehensive risk assessment under the guidance and direction of counsel, and I'll talk in a minute why that's important, so that they understand what their basic risks are. Now look, that assessment is going to look very differently if you're a General Electric than if you're a small startup. But every company, I would submit to you, should think about where its vulnerabilities are, where its pain points are, and what it's going to do to try and get out ahead of that. Why does doing that with counsel matter? Because as you do that process, as you do that analysis, you're going to find things that are embarrassing. You're going to find flaws in your systems or your procedures. And remember what I talked about before about the class actions and the regulators? They've discovered that the best way to win their lawsuits against you, whether it's the FTC or an AG or a private litigant, is to ask for all those assessments in their document requests when they sue you. Now, if you haven't done that assessment under the protection of the attorney-client privilege and the work product privilege, you're going to have to turn that over. But if you have done it under those protections, you stand a pretty good chance of keeping that stuff secret. Look, nobody likes when they turn over the rock and they see all the creepy crawlies underneath, right? Nobody likes to have to air that in public. And one of the ways you can minimize that is by, you know, working, having your consultants, whether they're CSI Identity or whoever, work in connection with counsel, a key and critical point. Final point I have to offer you is, final 2 points. First, develop a written information security plan. Regardless of how big or small you are, you should do it. It doesn't have to be big if you're a little company. It can be small. It can be medium-sized if you're medium-sized. But put down something on paper which has in it all the critical information that you need to respond to a data breach. How many of you today in the room, in the companies that you work with, have seen or are aware that your company has a written information security plan? Hands, please. Okay, about a third of the room, okay? How many don't know? Okay, a few, and the rest I assume are no. And you guys are at the cutting edge. You guys are at the cutting edge. You're here because you're interested and committed to this subject, and you're a technologically savvy audience. I would say that whether you're an entrepreneur starting your own website or just an employee of a big company, go and take that message back to your company and take it to heart. And then finally, think about who you do business with. Every computer that your computer connects to is bound by the weakest link in that other computer's security fence and the weakest link in those company's policies. So make sure that the companies you do business with have good and robust procedures. If you do all those things, you're not going to, you know, reduce the likelihood of a breach to zero, but you are going to minimize the chances of a breach or something really bad happening in the event that there is a breach. And that's the single most important thing I would say to you as, again, someone who's dealt with this for the better part of 15 years. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Joe. And to give you an idea of the timing of the class actions, they don't follow 6 months or a year later. Most of the cases, as soon as it's made public, within a week or 2 weeks, there's usually a class action lawsuit already filed. And to give you an idea of the monetary amount associated with that, most class action lawsuits sue for a year or 2 years of identity theft protection, which at a retail rate is anywhere from $100 to $200. So if you have 10,000 employees or customers and you lose their data, it's going to be times 100 to 200, and that's what the class action lawsuits are generally based on. So finally, we're going to go to Mike, and Mike's going to talk about, we've been talking a lot about the data breaches, but what do data breaches mean to the actual consumers or individuals whose information was exposed? So Mike, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Joe, you want to advance the slide? Okay. The quote on the slide isn't necessarily important from the fact that it was made, but the fact that the head of RSA Security, they're part of EMC and one of the largest security firms in the world, gave this statement in their opening remarks 2 weeks ago at the RSA conference. And he basically said, hey, we're really out of luck, not only as businesses, but as consumers. And I'd like to just show you from a time standpoint, as a consumer, it takes about 4.8 months to discover that a data breach has occurred. Okay, 4.8 months on average. It takes you about 12 or 13 of these, an hourglass, to repair your own identity if you suffer a data breach. So that's investing not only your own resources, including even if you have a notification service that you've already paid for, it takes you 12 of these. And then I've got my trusty stopwatch here. There's a spear phishing attack that happens every quarter of a second. I can't even start and stop the stopwatch that quickly. And every half of a second, there's a new website that's put up that's going to spam you or that's going to create an opportunity to steal your identity. Identity theft is occurring for each individual in the United States every 2.81 seconds. So as a consumer, you have to protect yourself. Joe, if you go on the next slide. So approximately 15 to 20 of you in this room last year will have received a data breach notice. In fact, let's just take a little pool. How many people last year got a notice in the mail from their financial institution or somebody that there's a service provider that they had a data breach or were involved? Okay, it's even higher. It's probably 70%. You all have been impacted by that. Now, what's interesting is the data that's most often stolen during a data breach is not necessarily your credit card information, your debit card, your Social Security number anymore. It's your name, and it's your email address and password. And as Monica said, 46 states have data breach notification laws, and in each one of those states, name and password are not considered your personal identity information. And you don't have to report on that, but that's a real problem, and the reason why the thieves are going after name, address, or name, address, and password, along with your email address, is that they can start building a synthetic identity. So they'll take Joe Ross's Social Security number, they'll take Mike Bremer's name and username and password, and then they get Joe's maybe driver's license number, all of which are valid but aren't a real identity, and create an account and steal from that. Don't get me wrong, thieves follow where the money is, but that's not the number one thing that was stolen last year in data breaches. Next slide. I'll leave you with this, and I brought my trusty stethoscope. This was invented in 1812, and it still has as much applicability as in 1812 as it does today. And that's the reason why we have preventive medicine. We've got to all take into account that you're going to be impacted by a data breach at some point in time. So the simple advice, whether you're a business owner or you're an individual consumer, the advice that I can give you is, think about common sense protection, and not only looking at but monitoring both your credit information, as we talked about, but even some of those non-credit pieces of information, like I mentioned with your password, your username. Your information is already out there. Look at Google Earth. Look at Facebook. Look at Twitter. Information, your basic information is out there, but you need to be able to monitor the information that's already out there. Second, make sure the alerting that you have or the monitoring that you have is on relevant information, and you get that information updated to you on a daily basis, because, as I said, with time against you, that information can be stolen so quickly. You wait 24 hours and you don't notice that somebody created an account in your name and you got alerted through your bank or a third-party service, it'll cost you a lot in the long run. And then finally, the last piece of advice is make sure whatever you do, have someone that can restore your identity to pre-event status, because you can't spend 12 to 15 hours of your own time going through that process, let alone being able to call the right people, sit on the phone, take time off from work to get it done. Invest in that, whether you're a business owner or you're an individual, and help yourself before a data breach occurs. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. And to kind of give you an idea of how much information is out there, we have a technology that basically, it's an artificial intelligence that sits in chat rooms in these IRCs and these forums. And it's on what we call the dark side of the internet. It's the place where we can't just go find. We have folks that work for us, and in these chat rooms, information is bought and sold. On a weekly basis, we get about 500 to 750,000 identities, meaning bits of information that is traded. So that's a mixture of credit card data, Social Security, emails, and passwords. And a lot of folks will say, well, we keep our passwords hashed. But there's also sites that you can go to, and if you give me 2 seconds, I can take you to a site, take a hashed password, plug it in, and it'll unencrypt it right there. So the information and the volume that's being exposed, there's a large amount out there, and it's pretty scary once you see in these rooms. And it's not expensive either. You can buy a credit card for about $3 to $4. You can get a name, date of birth, and social for about $5 to $7. So it's not a real high dollar venture to get into. You can get into it pretty easily. So now, as we go on, that was the last of our slides. We're going to open it up if anyone had any questions. And they've asked, if you do have a question, if you'll come to the front here, just due to the fact that they are recording.
So I saw there was one bullet point about working with vendors. So my group tends to work with a lot of vendors. We use a lot of third-party products. When we initially launch, we work closely with our security office to make sure they meet enterprise security policy. But do you have any recommendations or strategies after that on how to sort of continuously monitor vendors' security stance?
Sure, I do, and it's a great question. I would say there are a couple things. First is, in addition to making sure and putting your IT people in touch with their IT people, you want to be absolutely sure that your legal department has reviewed that contract and that the contract includes provisions in it requiring your counterparty to have and maintain and adopt best practices in the area of information privacy and security. You're going to want clauses on breach notification so that if they, your vendor, has a breach, they notify you so that you don't read about it in the paper first. You're going to want that contract also to say that you have the right to audit and inspect their security procedures, that they're going to pay for that. Now, I know you can't always get all of this, but I'm just saying, I'm just giving you the wish list. You're also going to want to have in that contract indemnification so that if they have a breach and you get charged by the FTC or you get sued, they're going to indemnify you. So all of those things are just kind of, I mean, that's like a no-brainer. And then it gets a little bit more exotic and dependent. That's the first step, right? Then you want to police it. You want to actually have in there, you know, that audit right. You want to exercise that audit right. Maybe exercise it once every 6 months, maybe once every year. That's what I would say are the most important things.
I would also add, make sure you understand exactly what information you're giving your vendors and customers. Understand what they need to do their job effectively for you, and don't give them anything more than what they need to do it. A lot of folks get with auditors and outside counsel. They'll be doing audits of a 401k plan or something internal where all the employees' information is out there. Once that is done, make sure you get that information back and you proactively ask them to destroy any of the information they have that's regarding your employees or your customers. Is there anyone else that has another question?
So you guys talked about class action lawsuits and some of the costs and some of the upfront work that has to get done to alleviate some of that risk. It costs money as well. Give a sense of what a data breach might cost a business, even a small one. Is there an average cost that someone can weigh against what they might spend up front?
Sure, and I'll let Monica chime in on this as well because we both deal with it. I mean, you know, look, it's going to be an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In fact, it's worth a ton of cure. Relative to what a data breach is going to cost you, even a small one, doing the work that we described up front to get this stuff right is going to be a fraction of the cost. I mean, the Sony PlayStation breach, those 88 class actions, I think they're over $1 billion now, or are they just shy of $1 billion? That's with a B, U.S. dollars. Epsilon, hundreds of millions. I mean, these are the numbers you're talking. You're talking multiple millions in any sizable nationwide breach. But even for a small company, I represent a hedge fund in New York right now. They had a single piece of PII that leaked out. No harm at all took place. It's a reportable event, so if they have to report. But to do the analysis and to fix things, it's going to cost them low tens of thousands of dollars for a single piece of covered PII.
That's right. I mean, it's very hard to predict because the breaches range from, you know, a few people being affected to millions of people. And it doesn't matter, even if you only had the personal information of two people compromised, it is still a security breach. One thing I'd like to add, though, is a lot of the companies you're representing here maybe service provider. As a service provider, your obligation typically is to notify the data owner, not the individuals right away. But depending of the contract you have in place with the company to whom you're providing the services, they may actually require you to indemnify for all the costs related to the indemnification if they had to provide credit monitoring services. So you really have to be prepared that it can cost you millions and millions.
And so, Terry, why not give us a couple examples? Because how you respond is also key as well. If you respond correctly, you can minimize some of that risk and some of the exposure and some of the negative press. So, Terry, why not walk us through a couple examples there?
Well, first of all, I want to digress a little. I really agree with Joe said. I'm in the communications business, and I would not even tackle a crisis, criminal, financial, public, without the attorney-client privilege, because that way I can give good advice without fear of, you know, because you do a lot of drafts. In the old days, when we wrote an annual report, we destroy every draft as we went, so we didn't have a track record, you know, and I know people that saved all that stuff and got in trouble. So attorney-client privilege to me is critical in handling these type of things or any kind of crisis. Okay, companies, off the top of my head, and both all three of these I've been involved in, has anybody bought shoes from Zappos? Okay, Zappos. You know, on a Sunday, and I've been a customer for years, and on a Sunday, I was on the internet. I saw they had a problem. Next thing you know, I get an email from them. That day, I got an email from them. they immediately notified all their employees and said, drop what you're doing. There's no other higher priority than this breach. They had 24 million plus customers, portions of their identity out there. I'm not sure how much it was. I don't think they had complete, but they had enough. So they started notifying people. I had to change my password on Sunday night. I couldn't buy it. But the point was, I had a lot of confidence because they were on top of it like crazy. They solved it. And why are they still okay and doing very well? And who bought them?
Amazon,
yeah. But they're still, business is great because, number one, it's a great business model. You know, you can buy any shoe you want, and it's usually a competitive price, and it's free shipping. So, I mean, the business model is what's keeping it going, and they solved it by not hurting their reputation. USAA, which I've been experienced with for years, they are, you know, they're just, they're all over security all the time. In fact, they overbug us, but we are changing passwords. We have multiple ways to get in. I'm not aware if they've ever had a security breach, and they're a huge insurance financial company in the financial business. And they're just all over you all the time and really worrying about security breaches. And I think they're doing it correctly, and they're a very, very successful company. The only other one that goes way back and might have not actually been a security, but the Postal Service. I had my identity stolen, and somebody charged a bunch of tires in Brooklyn, New York. And the next thing you know, they're on the phone to me right away, the Postal Service inspectors. I had to sign all kinds of forms, and they used my form to go to trial, and the guy was in jail, you know, for 10 years. And so they really got on it quick. So I was impressed that they got on it and solved the problem. So I guess the only thing I would add is, does anybody have a sense of humor here? I'm looking for does anybody know that 3 weeks ago, somebody hacked or did a data breach and they put thousands of usernames and email addresses posted online? And I hope nobody knows about it because it was youporn.com.
Yeah, it was a major breach that took place last week, about 1.6 million identities that were on there. And our technology captured that information when it was exposed. You'd be surprised how many people use their work domain on that site. We did a few random checks on that just for the fun of it. But
I saw it on Google. I had your hand.
So it is interesting. And one thing to keep in mind, if you are notified on a breach, so Zappos is a perfect example. Zappos tells you to change your username and password. Most people use the same username and password on their Amazon, their Zappos, their email, everywhere they go. So if you do receive one of those notifications, don't just change it for that particular site if you use it elsewhere. Because what happens is the attackers will go in and say, Zappos, you get a couple million usernames and passwords. Well, they can write scripts where they can just try those on multiple other sites as well. So they can take it from Zappos and go into Yahoo or Gmail and start plugging and running numbers in until they find which ones work and fit. So even if you change your Zappos one, make sure if you use the same password, which most people do, unfortunately, change it across your other accounts as well.
Let me ask a question on that subject. If you get a lot of junk mail, which I do, and so then someone said, well, you need to go down there and tell them you don't want to receive the email anymore. And somebody said, don't do that, because what you're doing is you're confirming your email to that user. I mean, I was deleting stuff like crazy. I don't delete them anymore because he said, they're testing it. They got a bunch of addresses and they're testing it. And they, oh, it is the real guy.
That's right.
When you say delete it.
Exactly. Right. Does anybody have any more questions before we wrap up? Yep. Sorry. Go ahead.
More directed to Mr. DeMarco, Mr. Haymeier. How much are you seeing Europe play into this? Their privacy laws are a lot stricter than ours here in the United States. And I've run into the circumstances in my career where over-notification can lead to hysteria, especially as sort of problems kind of flow across the pond. What's your kind of opinion on where we are in terms of U.S. European privacy laws right now and things leading to over-notification, and what kind of communication strategies could you suggest to kind of ensure if it happens across the pond, it stays there and doesn't impact our U.S. business?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you could have a whole conference on EU-U.S. Data issues. I mean, look, the bottom line is Europe has a different legal regime than the U.S., but the two systems are moving closer together. So, for example, right now, Europe is debating breach notification. And I think if they do have some form of breach notification, I'm actually posting some comments on some of the recent proposals of the European Council. If they do have that, you're going to see just more and more breach breach notification. And I hope they don't follow the pitfalls that we have in the United States where you have a patchwork of requirements. I mean, all the state laws are different. I hope they have one unitary kind of approach to the problem. I'm not sure that they will. And I also think the U.S. is moving towards a deeper understanding and harmony with European concepts like, for example, the right to be forgotten. The right to oblivion, which is a very uniquely, at this point in time, European concept. So I think that over time, you're going to see more convergence between the two legal systems. There are some important differences right now that companies need to take into account. But for the rest of our lives and our children's lives and our children's children's lives, these issues of breaches, reporting, class action lawsuits, regulation, and the public debate is going to only grow. It's not going away. Because increasingly, we're putting more and more of our lives into these ones and zeros we call bits and bytes.
Communications-wise, it's really a tough one because I think every case is different. And in many cases in crisis work, saying less or nothing is better than saying something stupid or inaccurate. And I would never do anything in a serious case unless I put out a written statement. I don't want somebody talking on TV or making a misstatement or being edited or that type of thing. I do a statement. If they don't like it, I don't care. Put a statement out. Joe clears it, and you put it out if you need to put it out. But, you know, you got to be careful. Sometimes you make it worse than it is when you respond. It just depends on what it is.
I would just add that, you know, it's very rare nowadays that a breach only affects people in the United States. So we often advise companies, if there are affected individuals in Europe, to consult with local counsel, because there are a few countries, for example, the UK and New Zealand, that have a voluntary reporting obligation. And it also often depends on the sensitivity of the data. If you're dealing with healthcare data, it's typically recommended to notify. There's also a directive in place that addresses telecom companies, and they have an obligation to notify. So Europe is moving there. It's just not exactly where the states are on the notification requirements.
Thank you. I think we had one more here.
You've talked a lot about how businesses can prevent breaches, but for smaller businesses that may not have the $1 million budgets of enterprise companies, what can those smaller businesses do? Just best practices. I know it seems kind of inevitable, but just any advice.
Jim, take that.
Yeah. The best thing for small businesses that I recommend is go ahead and as a business, pay for identity theft protection for the individual employees up front. Use it as an employee benefit, so they're going to have monitoring of their personal information. It's going to be timely and relevant. They'll see changes if new accounts are open, and most importantly, that restoration at the end. If you have that protection up front for those employees, or even in some cases the smallest businesses for their top customers, they're actually offering restoration only, so that in advance of a data breach, you've got a blanket of protection, because most of the people that are out there, even if it's a negligent insider, they're going to the path of least resistance, and they're not even going to breach their own business if the employees are already protected. Yeah.
And adding to that, I would also have the conversations and go through your policies. No matter how big you are, you can go through your policies on your laptops. Can the employees take their laptops home? What information is on their laptops? And put policies and procedures around that. Customer data, who has access to it, what are the changes and controls? If someone's terminated and they leave the business, did you take away their access rights? Did you change firewall codes? There's all these processes that, even small or large, you can still sit down and follow those steps, because as we mentioned, the majority of the leaks that happen are internally caused. It's either employees, and it's not necessarily always malicious. A lot of it is just negligence. When someone's just forgets and they take their laptop home, leave it in their car gets broken into, now you've lost your entire customer database and you're dealing with a breach. So those are things that you can do by being proactive and just having the conversations and reviewing internal policies.
Joe, if I could add to this, I think employee training is something that's really crucial, and it doesn't cost a lot. What we see, we haven't really talked about the timing of the notification. What we see a lot is within the company, it takes a week, 2 weeks, sometimes a month before a breach is reported to the people who actually realize this is an event that has to be made public. People have to be notified. If your employees are well trained and are aware of, you know, what are the consequences of personal information being compromised, you can notify the relevant people more quickly. just to give you some deadlines, most of the state breach laws don't actually provide a specific timing requirement. They only say that you have to notify without unreasonable delay as quickly as possible. There's only three state laws that provide that you need to notify within 45 days of the discovery of the breach. The HITECH Act, which deals with health information, requires notification within 60 days. Indiana, I don't know if anybody's here from Indiana. The Indiana AG has been very, very proactive and aggressive. We have a lot of clients who received a warning letter, I would say, that says, you know, Indiana residents have been notified more than 30 days after the discovery of the breach. That's really interesting because there's no timing set forth in the law. The law only says without unreasonable delay. So the AG just interprets it as saying, you know, 30 days. If it's over 30 days, it's too slow. You've wasted time. I think that's it.
Okay. So is there any other... Go ahead right here.
Hi. My name is Jen. I actually work with Terry at Pierpont. So,
you can't ask me a question.
I'm not going to ask you one. I can ask him anytime. My question actually involves old data that you have. So, like, I have clients who have had 10 years of databases that 10 years ago, this wasn't such a big deal. So this database of clients is on like 20 computers printed off in random rooms and file cabinets. How do you get your hands wrapped around that? Because this has become a really big thing in the last 2 years. So you can implement stuff for the data you have now. But what about all the data that's on files and computers that you really don't even know where it is? Like, how responsible are you for that? And how can you manage that?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. You know, if you really care about getting that right, and I think you should, there are a couple things. First is you have to, you know, again, when you do your data security assessment, that's one of the things, you know, that you cover. And that's what I routinely cover with my clients is where is your data? How old is it? How accessible is it? And then once you think about that, you have to think about if you have a lot of this old data, a closely related issue, which is your document retention and destruction policies. Because one of the key principles of best practices in the area of information privacy and security, and a requirement under European law to your point, sir, is that data is destroyed securely once it is no longer needed. So that is actually a key component of a good information privacy and security assessment. And look, it's not always easy. You may actually have to buy software, you know, pull an AS400 out of mothballs from the Smithsonian and, you know, power it up to run. It can be challenging. But you got to do it, or if you can't do it, at least say that you've considered doing it and then figure out whether you really need what's on those unreadable tapes or not.
Is there any other questions? I think we're about out. But one thing to keep in mind, CNET just sent a news release out that Southwest hotspots are a hacker's heaven. So that just came out just now during the meeting. So you guys might be a little careful when you're logging in around the town and downloading all the cool apps. Anything else for us, though? All right. I think that's it. Well, thank you all for coming. We appreciate it.